The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We are going to take matters slightly out of order. We're going to take up the public hearing and possible work session on HB 3354. Zach, would you tell us about the bill?
House Bill 3354 names Highway 30 between St. Helens and Rainier as the Chief Ralph Painter Memorial Highway and is amended to read the Police Chief Ralph Painter Memorial Highway.
And I think we have some folks signed up. Senator Betsy Johnson, Representative Jeff Barker, and Mayor Jerry Cole, if you could all come up. Like to go first.
I'll go ahead if I may. Mr. Chair, thank you. Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Beyer, and Committee, thank you for allowing me to appear today. For the record, I'm Jeff Barker. I'm the State Representative from House District 28. I'm here in strong support of this bill today. Chief Painter, who I did not know personally, but I knew by reputation, was an excellent chief. He was kind of the epitome of what a good police officer, a good chief of police should do, especially in the smaller towns. I spent several years patrolling that high stretch of highway up there when I worked for the Oregon State Police out of the old St. Helens office. And when this tragedy occurred, I was called up. Somebody called me up, and I immediately dropped a bill, this bill, so that we could have the highway in memorial to the chief. As you probably can imagine, after 31 years in law enforcement, if you don't know somebody personally, you know them by reputation. He has the best reputation, and it would be a great honor for the state to have his name on that stretch of highway, and I would appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, but I need to run.
Go right ahead.
Judiciary.
We understand.
Meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you. Chair Benz, Co-Chair Beyer. I'm Betsy Johnson. For the record, I represent Senate District 16, which includes the community of Rainier. And I am here in solidarity with the mayor, who is going to make the statement on behalf of the bill, on behalf of the community. But I can tell you, echo what Representative Barker said. Chief Painter was not only a fine police officer, he was a beloved member of the community. The town of Rainier, and I would dare say all of Columbia County, still is reeling with grief from the loss of this fine officer in the line of duty, and I support the call to pass House Bill 3354 as a fitting honor for somebody that gave the last full measure of devotion in the line of duty, and I commend this bill to your serious consideration and ask respectfully that you pass it.
Thank you, Senator, and you're going to stay with us for a while, or we understand you.
Sir. Thank you for having me today. My name's Jerry Cole, Mayor Rainier. First of all, thank you for your service. I always try to thank the public servants for their service.
We appreciate it. Thanks.
Co-Chair Representative Bentz, Co-Vice Chair Beyer, members of the Transportation Economic Development Committee, it's my honor to be here today to testify in support of House Bill 3354, which provides that U.S. Highway 30 between St. Helens and Rainier shall be known as Chief Ralph Painter Memorial Highway. With the support of Ralph's family and the community, I come here today to show my support for House Bill 3354. Ralph Painter was born July 17, 1955 in Sacramento, California. The family then moved in the 60s to St. Helens, where Ralph attended St. Helens schools and subsequently graduated from St. Helens High School in 1974. From there, he earned his associate's degree from Clackamas Community College. Professionally, Ralph's lifelong desire was to have a career in law enforcement. His career began in 1983 by joining the St. Helens Police Reserves. He then joined the police department in the city of Rainier in 1988. Ralph was a patrolman until 1999 when he was promoted to sergeant. His final promotion came in 2006 with his advancement to the chief of police. During Ralph's career as a civil servant, he also held a seat on Rainier City Council. Whether professionally or personally, Ralph always had a positive attitude, which he shared with all who came into contact. He was a great inspiration to the entire town, young and old alike. On January 5th, 2011, Chief Ralph Painter's life was tragically taken. Ralph left behind the love of his life, Amy. He also left his children, Julie Huer, Angie Nealon, Jeremy Howe, Jennifer Painter, Ryan Painter, and Riley Painter, and 12 grandchildren. This loss has tragically affected his family, the Rainier community, Columbia County, Citizens of Oregon, and public safety organizations throughout the Oregon, and I'd even say as throughout the nation. The naming of Highway 30 between St. Helens and Rainier would be an honorable memorial to Chief Ralph Painter and the local communities. With Ralph's history in St. Helens and Rainier, the naming of the highway connects the two cities with Ralph's life influences that he had in both communities. I'll say that it does not go unnoticed that our state's facing huge budget difficulties. If required, the signs can and will be paid for through private donations. Several community members have already approached me to offer their help with the payment of the signage. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Other questions for this panel? I have just one. How far are I'm not from your side of the state, Senator, so I'm just curious how far between the two towns.
It's about a 20-mile stretch between Rainier and St. Helens.
I think, Zach, are we waiting for any other paperwork on this bill?
Yes, sir. Ready to go.
Is there an amendment?
There's a dash one amendment.
And do we just, if my, I think we're prepared to work the bill if someone is in a position to make a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move that the dash one amendments drafted on March 24th, 2011 be adopted.
It's been moved that the dash one amendments dated March 24th, 2011 be adopted. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, that dash ones are adopted. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Please.
I'll jump.
I move House Bill 3354 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
It's been moved that House Bill 3554 pass to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
3354.
Thanks for the correction. Is there discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Lindsay.
Excused.
Representative Davidson.
Excused.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Shea.
Yes.
Chair Vann.
Aye.
Chair Reed.
Excused. And with that, House Bill 3354 passes. We need a carrier. Let's see, I'm assuming Representative Barker will carry. So we will assume that for the moment and with that, close the work session on 3354. And I'm going to open a work session on HJM 20.
Thank you.
I'm sorry,
thank you
hearing.
So very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. And we're going to take a 3-minute recess while we go retrieve Representative Conger.
And then
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Back to order.
I would move we suspend the rules to allow Representative Nathanson to vote on which one? House Bill
3354.
It's
been moved that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Nathanson to vote on House Bill 3354. Is there objection? Seeing none, we open the work session on 3354. Representative Nathanson, how do you vote?
I vote aye. And Mr. Chair, thank you for the consideration.
You're welcome. Representative Nathanson votes aye. We'll close the work session again on HB 3554. And 3354. Forgive me. And we will open a public hearing and possible work session on HJM 20. Zach.
House Joint Memorial 20 urges Congress to allow for unmanned aircraft testing in rural areas of the state.
Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And colleagues, very grateful for your time and interest in this very important bill. We'll talk briefly about what it does. HJM 20 simply asks the President and Congress to require the FAA to expedite approval of temporary flight restrictions to allow unmanned aircraft in military overflight zones. We have some amendments that we're going to ask for to this, unfortunately, and it has to do with the recent FAA decision. So the references to the military overflight, military operations area is what it's called, is the technically correct term, I think are going to come completely out of it with the Dash 1 amendments. So the remainder of the bill fundamentally just asks the President and Congress to urge the FAA to develop an expedited approval process for aerial testing of unmanned aerial vehicles, which I'm going to call drones in my testimony, just for the sake of clarity. And it asks for it specifically in rural counties with high unemployment. And, of course, that's important in the state of Oregon because, coincidentally, we have lots of rural counties with lots of unemployment. Very briefly, I just want to make sure that although I'm using the word drones, unmanned aerial vehicles come in a variety of shapes and sizes. They're generally smaller than normal aircraft, although they can be the size of manned aircraft. But they can be as small as almost model planes, if you can picture those. And the technology that relates to drones can be used in applications other than aerial applications, such as if you can picture the robots that go and test anti-personnel devices in various areas where our forces are deployed. They go on the ground, but they're using technology in part that is used in connection with drones. So unmanned aerial vehicles are drones, in my testimony. This bill is really about two things. It's about drones and jobs. Talk about drones. The drone industry, if you will, is a rapidly growing and increasingly important segment of the aviation industry. And, in fact, I've heard it described as the future of the aviation industry. We have an important connection here in the Northwest because some of the larger drone companies have originated here, not so much in Oregon, more in Washington. And, of course, Boeing is the big presence here. As we contemplate, so the second point obviously is jobs, and I want to talk briefly about what you need to create jobs, but you also need to be able to test drones and why this is important to my home district, District 54. Oops, for the record, I'm Jason Conger, representing District 54. Apologize for the brief delay in introducing myself. So as we contemplate how to create jobs and stimulate Oregon's economy, one of the things that has occurred to me is we need to focus on the assets that we have. We have many in this state and many opportunities to create jobs, but we need to be focusing on our strengths, if you will, instead of our weaknesses. We talk a lot about our weaknesses and the barriers that we have to creating jobs in this state, but we also have many assets. You really only need two things to stimulate research and development and testing areas for drones. One is you need a workforce. That's sort of the infrastructure for this industry, or for this particular part of the industry. You also need wide open spaces, and we have great big wide open spaces with few people and lots of air to test these things in eastern and central Oregon. Workforce. Let me talk just quickly about workforce. And of course, because I represent the city of Bend largely, I'm going to talk about Bend, but I mean central Oregon and eastern Oregon generally. But some of this information is specific to Bend. An independent study of the Oregon Department of Aviation completed in 2007 noted that more than 1,500 aviation and aerospace jobs were in Bend alone, resulting in an annual payroll of $68.3 million and more than $578.5 million in annual economic impact. I will venture a guess without any science behind it that there are fewer jobs in the aviation industry in the city of Bend now, but nonetheless, there's a history there, and that means there's a workforce, which is, again, is one of the components that you need to develop this drone testing and development industry. The other component of workforce development, of course, is education, and there's a real synergy here. There's an opportunity for our Central Oregon education institutions, which include Central Oregon Community College and OSU Cascades, to offer specialized engineering and technician degree programs to specifically suited to the drone business. Having such programs located in Central Oregon would increase the number of educational programs available for local residents and would enhance the region's workforce capabilities. And would also increase the draw to the area because there aren't that many schools that have this kind of specialized program, and yet it's a rapidly growing segment of the aviation industry with a bright future. So workforce. Wide open spaces, as I mentioned, airspaces in unparalleled abundance in Central Oregon. So finally, I want to mention a couple of things just pragmatically about how this came up. This is a locally driven bill. The idea of locating the drone industry came out of local work, led mainly by EDCO, which is Economic Development of Central Oregon. But there are also six counties and a couple of cities that have signed on to the effort. It's not a stretch, given the history of the aviation industry in Bend and the presence of OSU Cascades with an engineering kind of sensitivity in Central Oregon Community College, with the ability to create some programs, again, to develop the workforce and the infrastructure needed for this. Unemployment in Central and Eastern Oregon remains stunningly high. And for those of you who haven't been over there, that hasn't changed. Don't believe the reports in the news that we're over the recession, because although unemployment may have fallen slightly, it is still very high, from probably a minimum of 13% on the east side of the Cascades to a high of over 20. And the economic hardship is stunning. So the concept here, again, with or without the FAA expedited process that is advocated by this resolution, is to create a center of education and research and development as an incubator for projects, for drone projects centered on the Pacific Northwest and specifically in Oregon. The estimated impact, if we're successful in this, is more than 1,000 new jobs over the next 7 years and $54 million in annual payroll, an overall economic impact of $324 million per year once we get up and running. So that concludes my testimony. Again, I believe you have some Dash 1 amendments that we just got today from Ledge Council, and I think they're really specific to changing the language to accommodate the FAA's decision about military operations areas. I don't think it has any other impact than to take that emphasis out of the memorial.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Sheehan.
Representative Conger, is this the only thing standing in the way of those jobs being created, those companies sprouting up? Is this fly zone, I guess, the only thing?
No, it's a – thank you for the question, Mr. Chair and
You're
Representative
welcome.
Sheehan. That's a very good question. The answer is no, but it is the most immediate and most significant barrier, because right now drones, it's amazing when you start to read about this. Drones can take off, many of them can take off in 50 feet, and you don't need an airport, you don't need a runway, you don't need a control tower. They are much like those model planes that, you know, hobbyists go out and fly around in some respects, although a lot more sophisticated and packing a larger set of weaponry. The answer is no, but this is the most immediate problem. If we could get the FAA to approve a test area, and by the way, I should have mentioned that our two senators have introduced a bill asking the FAA to approve 10 new test areas for drones, because a major bottleneck in the drone industry is that they don't have areas where they can test them. The problem is they're flying up there. They're not exactly with civil aviation, and they're too low for commercial flights, but they do take up airspace, and there are safety issues. So we need this approval by the FAA in order for the companies to know they can go there and they can test their product. So until we get that, we will never build a drone industry in Central Oregon based around testing, which is what we're trying to do. We've heard from the companies that if we can get this FAA approval, they will move there. They're very interested. They recognize the advantages in Central Oregon, the natural physical advantages, you know, big wide open spaces where you can see forever, and there's not a lot of air traffic, and there aren't a lot of people underneath. So the other barriers, of course, come down to just normal business barriers to operating a company or moving a company into the state of Oregon. But with that said, I think the need is so great for these testing areas. If we get out in front and get a testing area, we will get these companies locating in Oregon. And once they do, the natural physical advantages and their, you know, their investment and physical presence in the area, I think, will keep them there.
Further questions? I have a couple. The current, they must be flying these things somewhere right now. Do you know where that is?
I think that's a great question. I don't know. I know that there are companies in Washington that are testing drones. I know that there are companies that have their headquarters on the East Coast that are drone companies, but I frankly don't know where they're testing them. I've read up on this and looked at some of the data that was provided to support the local effort to get the industry interested in Central Oregon, and what it indicates is that there are a number of companies in this industry. There's a lot of new technology coming out, and there's a lot of demand, not just for military applications, but for things like drug interdiction and just a variety of safety, public safety, and even probably as a result, commercial applications like aerial photography, things like that. So there's a tremendous amount of demand pulling these companies to get their products to market, and a real choke point for them is that they don't have enough areas where they can know that they will have airspace available. I think in many cases, although I'm not actually certain about this, but I think in many cases they can test them at a local airport, but they're subject to air traffic control instead of being able to take them out and spend a day or whatever they need to do, however much time they need to do, take them through their paces.
Second question had to do with some concerns that were raised over in my area when this idea was proposed, and it had to do with concerns of folks out in the wide open spaces of Eastern Oregon being spied upon by the drones. So I'm just curious, have you checked into what folks out there think, how these things fly around? And I'm just curious,
sure,
whether or not these are equipped with cameras, or if they're just out there flying about being followed by radar or whatnot. And I'm just asking the question that was asked of me.
Absolutely.
No,
Mr. Chair, I think it's a fair question. The answer, I think, is that many of these products can be used for invasive observation-type applications. I have probably two... I think areas that I get comfort And I did do some checking, although I did not go out into your district to ask people what they thought about it. But I did check with some folks who raise cattle, for example, out in areas that would potentially be flown over, and they didn't seem to be too concerned about it. The two areas of comfort that I would offer, one is that this is for testing. This is not for observation. So it's primarily to get them up in the air and see if they will fly and see how the controls work, see how the performance actually, you know, once they're in the air, not in the lab. So I think it's more the testing function that we would be dealing with than having them out there flying over and spying on people. Once they're developed and once they're deployed for various uses domestically and otherwise, then I certainly think that they could be used to spy on people. But I think in the testing phase, that's probably less of a concern. The other thing is that a lot of this has to be driven, I believe, by, with some local input on how the drones will be tested, and that remains to be seen how that would work. I guess I don't have a lot of insight into what would happen. If there was a concern, for example, about flying at certain times of day, these are not noisy vehicles. They're actually very quiet, not like civil aviation. But if there was a concern about mounting cameras on them, I think local people should get out there and say this is a concern and, you know, write letters to the FAA if need be, but primarily go to the companies and say, we don't want you spying on us. And, I hope that we ever get to the point where there are people working in the field testing these in Oregon so that we have those jobs that would come from that, to where people have a reason possibly to focus on that and make sure it doesn't happen.
Right. Thank you very much. Are there further questions?
Yeah.
Yes, Reverend Nixon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Jason. Do we know what the State Aviation Board has said about this? Have they offered any opinion on the drone question and on where it should be tested, et cetera?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, to my knowledge, the State Aviation Board hasn't weighed in on this, but that's not necessarily the case. I know there's been some question from the opinion seems to be split for private pilots, you know, people who are flying private planes. So there may be some concern there because you're now putting another vehicle into airspace that they could be flying in. But the nature of the testing, as I understand it, is that drones use altitudes that typically planes wouldn't be flying at. Mm-hmm. So they have a range of 5,000 to 8,000 feet typically that they'd be tested in. And so there aren't a lot of planes flying in those areas. And what would happen is there's a significant amount of communication that has to go on would happen in connection with the creation of a testing area so that people would know when they're going to be flying. Mm-hmm. And would know what altitudes they were at and could just avoid them.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure.
Yes.
It would be really valuable to, if we could touch base with some of them. It partly is just personal. I have a family member who happens to sit on it, and it happens to be where I get some of my guidance on aviation, so it's hard for me to evaluate on my own sometimes. And if we can get used for any of them, it'd be handy.
Further questions? Thank you. And, of course, having just received the amendment, we don't have the appropriate paperwork to move the bill today.
I understand.
Even if we wanted to. So thank you very much. I'm going to carry over HJM 20.
Thank you.
And I was delinquent not asking if there's someone else that wanted to testify on it. Seeing no one, I won't reopen. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on HM 2. Representative Winger.
Chairman, I haven't had an opportunity to testify in front of this committee yet. For the record, I'm Representative Matt Winger from House District 26. Appreciate the time hearing this House memorial, which simply asks for something. It's not a bill. So what was the genesis for this? When I first ran for the legislature, I did a ride along with the State Patrol, and some of you may know that Wilsonville is intersected by I-5, and along that patrol there is a rest area just south of Wilsonville, rather notorious a rest area that seems to attract a great deal of crime. And as I was on the patrol, we drove right by it. And I said, are you going to go into the rest area? And what I came to find out on that ride along is that to some degree the state patrol's given up on the rest areas because of some of the court rulings that make it difficult for them to eject people and things around that. So I thought that's a good idea for a bill. So I came to the legislature with the idea that maybe we could move the ball a little bit on the rest areas, but there's some difficulty around that, and I think the Department of Transportation is making some efforts. But I have I've traveled around the country in my car for various reasons, and I have seen some states that have some very beautiful rest areas. And what I've come to realize is that there are different models for running rest areas. In some states, like the state of Oklahoma, basically privatized them, and there can be vendors there, and those vendors are essentially then in charge of keeping the rest area's maintenance up and keeping it looking nice, and they actually look very nice. So that led me to asking questions about could we do that in Oregon? And interestingly, committee members, it turns out it depends on when you built your rest areas, because the federal law essentially says that rest areas built before a certain date certain are in one group, and rest areas built after a certain date or in another area and cannot be commercialized. So that's the reason for the House memorials. I'd like us to call on Congress to let us make a decision about what we want to do with our rest areas. The federal government simply giving us back the right as a state to decide what we want to do to our rest areas does not mean that we will do anything specific, and I'm not suggesting that we do anything specific, but we can't discuss things because certain things are just off the table. And I know you're going to hear some concerns about what would happen if they were privatized. I'm not even suggesting that that is what has to happen, but I think that's a broad concept, and what that would look like and what would be permitted to be sold or vended there is certainly something that I would hope that a group of stakeholders would get together and decide once we actually had the opportunity to control policy-wise what we wanted to do with this. So I hope that the members will support the bill under the philosophy that we'd like the federal government to let us decide what we do with the rest areas that exist in our state. And then ultimately, the second step would be for us to find a way to make these things much more inviting for people, where people feel safe and to pull over and use them for what we want them to use them for. And I think we can do that in a way in which the concerns that you're likely to hear can be resolved. But the first step is actually getting the ability to have that conversation. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Are there questions?
No questions.
Yes, there's. Representative Sheehan.
Representative Winger, it's sort of alluding to a public safety concern. Is that correct, or is this? It seems like there are a lot of issues at play here. Your argument seems public safety, but then there's a privatization aspect. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I can, Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan. I can tell you that I will not go into that rest area at night. There are many wonderful things that occur or that can occur at the rest areas. There are crimes, drug-related, sex-related crimes that occur. We also have issues of vagrancy, people who have actually taken up residence in some of our rest areas. Various issues that need various things dealt with them, none of which I think are what we actually want our rest areas to be about. I think we want them to be places that travelers can pull over 24/7 and access the facilities to go to the bathroom and to walk a dog or something like that, and where they always feel safe. And that is just not the reality in our rest areas. We're not even close to achieving that reality, and I think we need to have an entirely different conversation about them in order to rectify that.
Follow. So is this a matter of jurisdiction? Can state troopers not enforce something there? And I apologize if I just missed this in your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan, part of the issue is that I'm not the lawyer, so somebody needs to define this, but as I've had it described to me, this is public land, and therefore you have some First Amendment issues and people being able to... there's just been some court decisions that have created very wide latitude about activity at rest areas. And so it makes it very difficult for the State Patrol to believe that their time is well spent in the rest area, because people, they either don't feel that they have the authority to remove somebody, or somebody's likely to return quite quickly.
But if they saw a crime being committed, they could stop them. That's not your testimony, right?
Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Byer.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not going to go into this too much because I think there probably is going to be testimony afterwards, but last session, I think that's been a big concern for all of us, the rest areas. So last session in House Bill 2001, which was the transportation package, we did turn over a number of our rest areas to the Travel Information Council, who have partnered up with local communities to go in and clean these out, and they've been working, doing some amazing things at the one in Wilsonville now. And we're looking at other types of legislation to give a little more authority for enforcement in those areas. So we have been doing some things, and I thought there are other people who can probably speak to it better, but there have been some efforts made, and we might even be looking at something additional this year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, I appreciate that, and I do agree that actually some work has been done. I think that this is the transformation session, and it's an opportunity to look at doing things differently. And we talk a lot about where to find cost savings, and right now the rest areas actually cost the government money to maintain. I think it is possible to get to a place where they don't cost the government money to maintain, and I think that's a potential win-win solution where we could get something that's a benefit that's provided to travelers on the road, and we don't have to necessarily make an expenditure to do it.
Further questions? Just have one. The concept I've always had of these our federal highway system has been one of you pay your share for the use of it when you buy your fuel, and then you drive onto the road, which you've paid for when you bought your fuel, and away you go. And if you come to a facility that is a part of that system, such as a rest area, you should expect that part of what you paid for that fuel pays for taking care of that accoutrement to the road system. If we choose to step outside that mold and begin to use other means of either raising income from the use of the system or generating other monies for utilize other means of raising money from the system, where does that end? I'm just curious, because it seems like quite a step, as you just said, a transformation. What actually do you anticipate? How far could this go, I guess, is my question.
Mr. Chair, on rest areas or
government? In general, because the conversation, I think the idea is that we have a public device that is a freeway, a system that moves you from one place to another for which you pay when you buy your fuel.
Okay.
And the rest areas are a necessary part of that system. I agree with you. Until recently, the one in Ontario was an embarrassment, but the travel information TIC has taken over. It's a great welcoming spot now for the state of Oregon because of that transformation. And so I'm agreeing there's a problem. I'm also noting it's being addressed, maybe not as broadly as we would like yet, but I'm trying to see how far should this door to this other approach be opened, if at all.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to be clear, I wasn't suggesting that anybody would have to pay additional money to enter a rest area. I mean, I think where states have modeled this, they're still free to the public to enter, to stop and walk their dog and use the facilities and those kinds of things. There may be a vendor or something that's going on that is a profit center for someone that allows them then, as part of that contract, to pay for the maintenance of it, but people are not charged to actually enter the rest area and use it for what we essentially want the rest area to be used for. In answer to your question, I think if you can find a win-win scenario, you should try to grab it. I mean, if there is a way to eliminate the cost because somebody who's running a business of some kind or another in the rest area will absorb that cost as a part of that contract. So you still have the service available to the public, and you have eliminated the cost. And you can also find a way with stakeholders, because I think you're going to hear from some of the truck stop areas that they don't want the competition, and I get that. I mean, you don't want a public contract to be competing with a private entity, but it may be possible to find something that it could be a profit center there that won't necessarily directly compete with the truck stop. Maybe not, but if you can find that win scenario and provide a public benefit to, or a benefit to the public without, and reduce or eliminate the cost, I don't know why we wouldn't want to at least explore that and see if we can do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, President Byer.
Sorry again. I think the other thing that I have concerns about, and that is, that if we do start allowing that to happen and people can get on the freeway and stop at the rest area and grab something to eat or drink or a snack on, and then just keep going up, you know, north or south on the freeway and never enter into our communities and support our businesses that exist there. So that's somewhat of a concern for me, is that I think it could have an impact on local businesses.
Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And it may be, and Matt, feel free to answer, feel free to offer thoughts. I guess there's going to be other testimony. But I wanted to help us more with landscape of kind of where this kind of stuff happens in other states, how they do it, how we visualize it. I know, you know, as a graduate student on the East Coast driving, was it Route 1, you know, and I think they may have had a different set of rules than Oregon has, for instance, or a different set of variances. What do we have any sense of what other states do and how it looks?
I don't have it in front of me. I could get you that. I know that as part of the New Jersey Turnpike, they do some of this. It's kind of a checkerboard. It just depends on the state. Some have done this, but if you do any travel by car, if you do any road trips, it's not difficult to see these. I mean, when you see a rest area that has somebody vending or doing something in there, you can pretty much tell that must be one of those. These are very well manicured rest areas.
Yeah.
They are high quality, and that's attractive to me. I mean, I think that's what we envisioned the rest areas to be, and it may be that the government just has too many things that people are requesting of it, that it's just not able to allocate the funds, mm-hmm. the time and the energy into this. That may be true of a lot of things, and that's why I suggest that this is an opportunity to find a win-win scenario where I think we can get to a place where most people can be very satisfied.
For me, I just want to visualize, and we can take it offline, but visualize, like, what's the state that does it best, right? What's the place that does it best? Where is it? And I understand it's a checkerboard, but is there an example, is there a vision for us to look at that would say, oh, yeah, we should be like that? And my related question for, I guess, anybody testifying is, what are other options in addition or in lieu of this to help address, I think, probably an interest we all share, which is to have rest areas that don't suck. And I share Representative Byer's question, and also interested in the things she said about what was done in the transportation package.
Further questions? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a number of people signed up. Bob Russell, Paul Romaine, John Anderson. They could come up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland with the Romaine Group, and I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. With me to my right, your left, not politically, is John Anderson, and he will testify in a little more detail. And the person to my left will introduce himself at some later point. We are in opposition to the memorial, not because it's not well-intended. We understand what the representative wants to do, and frankly, having rest areas that are well-maintained and safe is a very noble goal. That's what we all want. As Representative Beyer stated earlier, that was, we think, we took a big step towards that 2 years ago. And you'll hear a little bit later from Travel Information Council that what they are doing and the sort of transformation that's going on. Our concern is competition, basically, with, in effect, the rest areas that are out there that are commercial, the travel plazas, the towns that people go by, the service stations that are off the road, the people, talking with one very sharp state representative earlier, talking about the fact that we actually planned these things based on what the land use and zoning laws were, where we could put stuff in, and travel plazas were built, restaurants were put up, gas stations were put up, and now we're facing, in effect, these areas that were just supposed to be free, open rest areas, potentially becoming competition. We don't think that's the proper role. We would just as soon that you leave this to the private enterprise. We do support the idea of making these rest areas comfortable, and we think that's going on right now. And I'll let John talk a little bit in more detail.
Good afternoon. I'm John Anderson. I am president of the Truck and Travel. It's a truck stop in Coburg on Interstate 5. I'm also here to speak in opposition of the resolution. Our highway system, the highway system in Oregon, is a mature system. It's cast in concrete and asphalt. The services along these routes are there because they are economically viable. The services that are not offered along those routes are not there because they're not economically viable. I'll share a little real-life case study. Last weekend, Alaska Airlines suffered a little meltdown with their computer systems. Myself and my family were lucky enough to be at LAX when we found out about it. Our solution was to rent a car and head north. And so for the next 14 hours, we drove 900 miles and arrived in Eugene about 3 in the morning. During that time, we found every service we wanted when we wanted it. And not only that, there were choices. Those services were there because they were economically viable, not because the government put them there. They were clean, they were well lit, and they were accessible. 35 years ago, my father and four other gentlemen built the Truck and Travel in Coburg. To do so, they put everything they owned online. With God's grace and a little elbow grease and a whole lot of luck, it survived. Next year, ODOT plans to realign the roads at that interchange, which will destroy or take out our gas station. It's our intention to rebuild that, move it, and rebuild that gas station. If we are going to have to compete with the state for customers, there's no reason for us to rebuild that station and invest in our community or continue to invest in our current operation, because we can't compete with the state. It's tough enough to survive in today's environment. I guess I just said that. Sorry. We and most every other business along the highways and byways of this state are small businesses struggling to survive. The last thing we need is to have to compete with the government for the very customers they're putting the food on the table of our employees. Think about when you drive down the freeway. You spend money. If you stop, you'll spend some money. If you stop at a rest area and you spend money at that rest area, part of that money will then go to take care of that. You are taking a dollar out of my pocket and out of my employees' pocket, because when you drive down the freeway, you're not going to spend an extra dollar someplace to make it look better. You're only going to spend what you're going to spend on that trip. And if you don't, I'll guarantee you, if somebody doesn't stop on our interchange, I have no chance of selling them anything. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I am also here to testify in opposition to the memorial. I've handed, passed out to you a copy of a study that was done in, it was done in 2010 about the impacts of commercialization of rest areas on truck parking. And my issue is, in fact, truck parking. When the economy was rolling back in 2007, the lack of truck parking really was a national crisis. Certainly, you all have observed trucks parking on the on-ramps at interchanges on the freeway early in the morning or late at night because the travel plazas are full, the rest areas are full. There's no place else for us to go. And this study clearly demonstrates that if you have commercial operations at rest areas, there is a reduction in the available truck parking. And as the economy begins to improve again, I know that we will have more trucks on the road. We will have a greater need for truck parking. And a good deal of the reason to park a truck is because we are required to take 10 hours off duty every day to get adequate rest so that our drivers are rested when they're driving down the highway. And from our perspective, they need a comfortable place where they can park, go off duty, get in the sleeper, and get their rest so that they can safely operate the truck the next day. And in this study, you will find that there are 14 states that allow commercialization at rest areas. They're all listed, and it also shows the impact of on truck parking in each of those states. So I hope that you don't move this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Questions for this panel? Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure where to begin on this because I'm a free market guy myself, and I know the rest stop right next to your facility and the truck parking, and it sounds like if there's an issue with I'll deal with truck parking first, that would leave opportunity for the plazas to put in more parking to bring more customers in if there's not as much at the rest stops. Would it not open up the door, and it's probably go to both sides?
Sure.
But if we took away parking for trucks, that'd put more at the travel plazas to spend more money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Weiner, you know, it's difficult in Oregon to site a travel plaza these days. Our land use laws are fairly stringent, and it is difficult for them to grow. So we're not seeing a lot of new travel plazas or expansion in travel plazas. And the lack of truck parking is so acute that even if they were able to expand significantly, we still wouldn't have enough parking spaces. So any parking space that we have today is very important to us, and we want to maintain it tomorrow.
We currently can park right around 200 trucks at our facility. If we were unable to continue in business, those 200 parking spaces would go away. The cost to and trade-off to build those is as more trucks come on the freeway or as the economy grows, we would address that. In our particular case, we've been waiting for ODOT to do this project since 2001. And it might happen next year. We've taken several proposals to the city to expand and been basically asked to wait until the roads are done.
And if I may follow up, this will be kind of to you as the business owner here, but with the rest stop right down the road, wouldn't that leave opportunity for you to bid for that contract to put your facility in that rest area so now you can provide food services for truckers and people down there? Because I'm somebody who has stopped at rest stops and had some unwanted advances in the bathroom that blew me away. When you're in Baker City, Oregon, you wouldn't think anything like that would happen to you, but
it's April Fool's Day, everybody.
And you meet Representative Smith there. But because I think is what we're trying to get at is stopping some of the bad stuff that's happening, Adam. It's not about putting people out of business. It's giving business owners an opportunity to bid for a contract. Hey, keep the grass green, keep everything mowed, make sure there's not any drug activity going on there. So when I'm going down the freeway, if I'm stopping at a rest stop, I wouldn't be stopping at your station anyhow. But this way I might get a soda or a coffee from you if you're at the rest stop.
I'm going to preempt in here, Paul Romaine, just to answer that question. Just because you have a commercial setting doesn't mean you don't have crime. Witness just about every day in every newspaper in the area we live in, Northwest Portland. Nice businesses, Pearl area, Old Town, which is at least coming around. And the stories you hear all the time are crime, 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 drugs, everything that you're getting in any place. It's an enforcement problem, no matter whether you have a commercial activity there or not. It's basically going in there and stopping something, a crime from occurring, or at least prosecuting if you can, if a crime does occur. What happens is if you now take someplace just down the road and give an opportunity for something else to go in there, you are, in effect, competing with what exists, the commercial activity that exists in the truck or travel plaza. And Mr. Anderson's travel plaza, if something would be commercially viable to put in, like another fast food stand or something like that, it could probably go into his existing travel plaza. The fact that it would be just down the road would draw traffic away from everything else that he has in there. And I think, frankly, would just provide unfair competition. When Mr. Anderson cited his place, that's the laws allow a travel plaza there. When you have all these rest areas that were never plotted for any kind of commercial activity, and now you're saying potentially they could be at commercial activity, and literally they're that would be totally unfair competition to what exists today.
My initial response is, well, we pay about $40,000 a year in property taxes. Why would I want to pay more property taxes to provide the same service that I provide today within a 7-mile radius? When you're driving down the road, you don't think in a 7-mile span. You think in 40 or 50 mile span. So you're going to stop in this 40 mile or 50 mile window. You're not going to stop twice in that 40 or 50 mile window. So I can only service you once. The truckers are going to think more of an 100-150 mile window. And so I have a capital facility that is already in place that provides those services. I would like to expand it, and I hope to in the coming couple years. But it would not make sense for us to go 7 miles down the road and to build that or provide that service.
Representative Smith.
Do we have another panel coming up, or is this our last
panel? We do. No, we have another panel.
I can hold off my question in case it comes up.
Further questions for this panel? See none. Thank you very much. Art Stevenson, Ann Wright, and Craig Campbell. Stevenson, do you want to go first?
Sure. Representative Benz, co-chair Beyer. My name is Art Stevenson. I'm the president of the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon. I'm also the vice chair of the Randolph Shepherd Vendors of Oregon. Currently, the federal law, I've supplied you with all copies of the proposed bill that we're going to urge our federal legislators to change. And in that law is what we refer to as the Kennelly Amendments, which allow blind license managers in the Randolph Shepherd Vending Program to do the vending machines located in these rest areas across Oregon and actually across the country. These amendments were put into an act to provide employment opportunities for blind persons across this great country of ours to a community that suffers with a 70% to 85% unemployment rate. I'm opposed to this bill because it does not talk about the Randolph Shepherd Vending Program, allowing the priority to remain, and therefore the hundreds of blind persons who are making a living now servicing the vending machines at these locations would probably lose their jobs because, quite frankly, we wouldn't be able to compete against those who would be allowed to bid on these locations. I might also like to add that as a manager here in Oregon, I do know about these rest areas and talk to the managers who have vending machines in these locations. And quite frankly, I believe that there are very few rest areas here in Oregon that could be privatized, because I do not think it would be profitable.
Too loud, huh?
Okay. So with that, I would urge you all to look at different alternatives, but not to privatize and commercialize our rest areas, because you would be hurting the blind license managers here in Oregon. And, I do think there is some crime problem there, and those issues should be addressed, but, those can be handled in other ways.
Thank you. Ann.
My name is Ann Wright. I'm a board member of the Blind Business Enterprise Program of Oregon and president of the Randolph Shepherd Vendors of Oregon. I would just echo what Art Stevenson had to say and the financial impact this would have on a lot of our managers here in Oregon and across the country. I spoke to one of them this morning, and it would basically put her out of business. We have stands and vending facilities in public state buildings and properties throughout the country. Some of us have facilities like myself. I run a cafeteria in the Department of Motor Vehicles downtown. The woman I spoke to this morning has a vending route, and the biggest chunk of her vending route is at a rest area. Bringing in more competition would basically eliminate her business. So I speak in opposition of this.
Thank you. Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Travel Information Council. We, too, are in opposition to the memorial. Want to talk a little bit about the experiment that we've been pursuing since the passage of House Bill 2001 during the last session, where the Travel Information Council took over management responsibilities for 10 rest areas, one of which, and the largest of which, was the Baldock Rest Area, which had a reputation for having a rather large crime problem, having a number of homeless people living there who had lived there for decades. And as a result of the work that has been done by the Travel Information Council, mostly because after having discussions with ODOT, the idea was that we have somebody who cared about doing specific work around those rest areas to make them a better place to be. Of the 39 families and people that were living in the rest area as homeless, none of them now remain. 37 of them have been placed in housing, have been connected up with human services in Clackamas County, and the two remaining decided that because of the presence of the Travel Information Council, stepped up law enforcement patrols by state police that the Travel Information Council arranged, they decided to move on. As a result of contracts with local providers of cleaning, landscape design and management, and that sort of thing, the rest area is now much cleaner. It's much safer. We have on-site management most of the time there. And as a result of that, the crime has been reduced. Now, we still have a panhandler or two, but because of freedom of speech issues, it's much more difficult to address that particular problem. But the end result is by having an entity who is paying attention to what's going on those rest areas and whose goal is to not only try to make that place a better place for people to visit, but also by putting together coalitions of local government, local business, we've been trying to make those places a location where when people come there, they're enticed to want to visit the surrounding area for personal reasons, for historical reasons, for business reasons, so that they're trying to experience more of Oregon as a result of their visiting the rest area. That's a vision that we've been trying to carry out in this first phase of the Travel Information Council's responsibilities for rest areas. And we're having ongoing discussions with the Department of Transportation about the possibility of expanding that as well. So that kind of touches on what the Travel Information Council has done to try to resolve some of the problems that were identified around rest stops in Oregon. Granted, we only have 10 so far, and there are a number more to be dealt with, but it's a good start, and we've had some pretty tremendous success so far.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Reverend Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if there is a if there's anything along the lines of where Representative Wingert is trying to nudge us a bit with, I think, some really legitimate interests. One being, so we have some options. Two, so we improve what we're doing. Three is trying stuff, seeing what works. I think all of those are not falsely noble, but actually meaningful and valuable, with some of the concerns we've heard today, like preserving promises that were made and local businesses. I think, although I know people must be in uncomfortable chairs and they're talking about, well, we need to limit competition so we can preserve competition, but it's sort of a weird, you know, sort of a weird conversation. But then also ensuring access of truck parking. I'm wondering if there's anything, I don't know if it's amendments, I don't know if it's doing a memorial plus a bill that actually, you know, ain't no such thing as a house memorial with teeth, you know, but there's a, but maybe there's a bill. Is there anything, Craig, or anybody that you can think of that would help balance some of these competing interests?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not sure, one, I'm the best person to ask that question of, and two, whether or not I would be able to give you a good answer to that question off the cuff. So this is one of those ones where I'm going to go ahead and pass on that question.
And it might be a question for
somebody
else.
I don't know. May have a better answer.
Further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much, and thank you very much for joining us today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Memorial 2. And before I open a work session on House Bill 2081, I'm going to just announce that we're going to carry over House Bill 2328 to Monday. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2081. Zach.
House Bill 2081 requires the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt rules establishing requirements for certain heavy-duty trucks and box-type trailers.
And colleagues, as you may recall, we've had our hearing on this. There is, however, an amendment. I believe it's a -4. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the -4 amendment to House Bill 2081.
Representative Byer has moved the -4 amendment to House Bill 2081. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Smith.
As I recall, the hearing we heard, there were people who were pushing an amendment, and then there are other folks who say, well, it's not a consensus amendment, and others who are saying we'd rather this bill not happen at all, even though we think something needs to be done. What's the status of the dash fours and that conversation? And I thought I remember there being some pause of our other co-chair given that interchange. Can you give us a little update, or does somebody give us a little update on where we stand?
I think this might be a moment to call Mr. Russell forward and have him address that exact issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I've asked Andrea Salinas, representing the Oregon Environmental Council, to join me. I'd be happy to walk you through the changes from the dash one to the dash four, so you can see what we have done. If you'll turn to page two of the dash four, lines 21 through 23. It says this: the offense described in this section, unlawfully idling the primary engine of a commercial vehicle, applies on any premises open to the public. That particular change was requested by the Department of Environmental Quality. On line 27, we added the words, if it is necessary, in that sentence, to make it very clear that what we're talking about, as far as idling is concerned, is only when it is necessary. And that was at the request of the Oregon Environmental Council. On page 3, line 2, we added the words, the need to operate, and again, the premise was the same. If you don't need to, we don't want you idling. And that was also requested by the Oregon Environmental Council. On page 4, on lines 6, 7, and 8, we added a new provision that prohibits idling when a driver is taking their 10-hour rest period on or adjacent to a kindergarten or grade 1 through 12 school. So when a driver's got 10 hours off duty and they're parked in their truck to get their sleep, they cannot idle while they're doing that on or adjacent to a school grounds. And then there was some testimony about the provision where there's 30 minutes allowed waiting to load or unload, or 30 minutes allowed to load and unload, that someone could just turn off their engine and turn it back on again and restart the clock. So we added on line 21 on page 4, during a single loading or unloading event, to make it very clear that that 30-minute provision was only to apply one time. And those are the changes that are occurred from the dash 1s to the dash 4s.
Good afternoon, Chair Benz, members of the committee. OEC, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Environmental Council. And as Bob Russell stated, OEC does support the dash fours before you today. Although we would have hoped for a stronger bill, we agree that the proposal before you is will do more to reduce idling than we currently have now. The Oregon Trucking Association has agreed to revisit how well the regulation is working, gathering more information than just anecdotal evidence, so that we and others can come forward in future legislative sessions to suggest revisions to the law if it's not doing its intended job. And we thank Mr. Russell for the work that's been done.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Yes, Representative Smith.
Maybe this falls into discussion. It's very helpful, and thank you for calling them up. Assuming we move this bill, Bob, I hope we might consider on the Senate side looking again at the temperature range and trying to be, you know, tutored by data on the temperature range. I don't know if it needs to get any colder, but I don't know if it's 75 or 78. It sounds like a little thing, but actually might be a big difference, and I don't know too much. But I understand it now. When you say you support the amendments, that means not only do you think these amendments are better than the, you know, than the original bill, but also that means you support the bill with the dash four amendments. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, we do.
Thanks.
Further questions? See none. Thank you both very much. Is there further discussion on the 2018-4, amendments to House Bill 2081. Seeing none, is there objection to the dash 4 amendments? Seeing none, the dash 4 amendments are adopted. And with that, is there a motion on the bill?
I move House Bill 2081 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sheehan moves House Bill 2081 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Smith?
I'll just say on the record for this portion that I do hope we'll take a look at this in the future, and I do hope we'll look at that temperature range. I don't want to burn anybody, and I don't want to freeze anybody, but I don't know if we know the best temperature range, and a statute is a relatively blunt cudgel to address something like that. And I hope that I hope the bill proponents will continue to look at that on the Senate side and see about. I mean, it might just be a few degrees, but it might matter. Thanks,
Mr. Weidner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this, I'm just wondering about the enforceability. You know, how are you going to monitor this? How are you going to watch it? I mean, a trucker, if I'm driving a truck and my cab's cold, or if I'm worried about losing if I'm hauling produce and worried about losing that and keeping it cool, I'm going to disregard this because my freight's more expensive than the ticket I could get for idling too long. And to me, I know everybody supports it and everything, but it seems kind of like an undue burden, and I'm wondering how they're going to enforce any of the stuff that we're doing here. I mean, unless you have a state policeman sitting right there when the trucker pulls over, how do you know?
Do you want me to ask Mr. Russell to come back up and address your question?
He doesn't need to. I mean, because I don't think there's any real relevant way unless he wants to come up and answer that question.
He looks enthusiastic. Mr. Russell.
It might incriminate you answering this question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Weidner, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. When I testified the first time, I talked about the complexity of the trucking industry. And because of that, it requires a fairly complex regulation. And that's what you have before you. There's no question. In terms of your question about maintaining the temperature for a load that requires temperature control service, like vegetables or food or whatever, there is a provision in here that specifically exempts that from idling so that can continue because, I mean, it's very necessary. We don't want to have spoiled food. But there are a number of instances where it becomes very clear when someone shouldn't be idling. I receive a number of complaints from local communities every year about trucks idling where they shouldn't and for reasons that they shouldn't. And I believe that this gives local law enforcement the necessary tool to take care of those issues. I also believe that it will be helpful to trucking companies. As you know, fuel is an extremely expensive part of doing business as a trucking company. The companies are always looking for ways to save fuel, and reducing idling is one of the principal reasons. I think this will help the trucking companies reduce idling. So I think that there are a number of significant benefits, and when you take those together, there are also significant benefits as a result of that from lower emissions, whether it be particulates, carbon, and those kinds of things, so that it will be a significant improvement on our environmental footprint.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Representative Sheehan, keep in mind we are...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. I'll keep this very, very brief.
Thank you very much.
I'm voting yes on this, but I have to say that this is one of several things that we've seen come before this committee or will come before this committee where an industry is allowing themselves to be regulated and participating in being regulated when I think the regulations are absurd. And they're doing it because they don't want
further regulations that would be even more absurd. And I'm uncomfortable doing this. I'm only voting for this because the trucking industry is agreeing to this. I don't think this is fair at all to the trucking industry, and I think it's a bully tactic, and I don't like it.
Thank you, Representative Sheehan. Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Lindsay?
Excused.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Chair Reed?
Excused.
Chair Vance?
Aye. Having received the majority of the votes, House Bill 2081 as amended has moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Noting Representative Lindsay, Chair Reed are excused. And I need a carrier. I'm taking it from your remarks, Representative Sheehan, you don't want to carry. Is there anyone else that's enthusiastic? I will carry.
Mr. Enthusiasm.
Exactly.
Thanks, buddy.
I will open a work session on HB 2167. And Zach, tell us about the bill.
House Bill 2167 increases the maximum reimbursement from the Oregon Production Investment Fund for film and television production for certain films.
Colleagues, we have two amendments to this bill. I'm thinking everyone has reviewed them. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment drafted on March 25th be adopted.
Representative Sheehan moves the Dash 1 amendments drafted March 25th be adopted. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Is there a motion regarding the Dash 2s?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments drafted on March 24th be adopted.
Representative Sheehan moves that the Dash 2 amendments drafted on March 24th be adopted. Is there any discussion? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're on the Dash 2 of the film and video.
We are.
Right? And I'm sorry I had to leave the room for just a moment. Did we have testimony explaining what the Dash 2 accomplishes?
Not yet. Would you like some?
I would.
I think we have folks here who are willing. Vince, why don't you come up?
Thank you, Chair. Chair Benz, members of the committee. The Dash 2 amendment was proposed to give the legislature the option on an annual basis where the tax credit program would stay in effect, but prior to every fiscal year, 30 days prior, the legislature could enact, and we had legislative counsel spell it out so it is effective, that effectively the legislature could fund the program at the discounted rate that we offer to the tax credit in lieu of the tax credit.
Thank you. Questions? Ben? Any questions, Representative Smith?
Yeah. Is Lana around? She was outside. Oh, there she is. I had a question that might be that I'd like to address.
You want someone else to come forward?
Yeah, Lana Vinker, please.
Representative Smith, do you need me to stay up?
Yeah, maybe, because you want to edit her answer.
For the record, my name is Lana Vinker. I'm a casting director in Portland, Oregon.
Hey, Lana, it's good to see you. I saw you in the hall, but you were talking to somebody else. Wanted to know if you have thoughts on our overall system of tax expenditures. It's beyond the scope of this bill to some degree, and you can decline to answer, no harm. But overall system of tax expenditures and thoughts of your community on helping to address that. I will lay bare my own concern. This is one of the tax credits I like more than others. And I have real concerns about overall process of getting finally to grips with some portion of the credits, but the overall arena of tax expenditures, we do very little to come to grips with it. And wondering if you have comment to make, or if you would be interested in being in common cause on that broader effort, even as we deal more myopically with this one at a time. And I have the same question for you, Vince, but Lana's more of a private citizen.
I'm a private citizen, so I'm not sure I understand the question.
It's not very understandable. Do you think it is worth us addressing our overall system of tax expenditures?
I am not an expert in that area at all. The only thing that I can really speak about, Representative Smith, is the success that I've noticed with the program as far as the jobs that it's brought, not only to actors and extras and crew members and my own company, but just noting that this is going to be the busiest year ever for film in Oregon, and that these jobs would not be coming here if we didn't have the program. So that's my main reason for being in support of it.
Mm-hmm. Chair Benz, Representative Smith, I'm not sure my position is allowed to address the broader perspective, but I can address a few of the issues relating. I think the sunset provisions for our program are actually beneficial. I think it is a worthy opportunity to review on a regular basis this program, since by and large we are looking at the broad environment where we're looking at other states. And if in the future there is a time when we don't need it because the competitive landscape is such that we do compete, I think, you know, when the sunset clause comes up, it's a worthy time to review. So in respect to this credit, I think that particular concept is a very good one. Does that help some of your...
At least it bails out the question. Thanks.
Actually, I appreciate Representative Smith's question and the device, the credit, is fortunate in that, given the media you work within, it provides an opportunity for the state of Oregon to benefit much more than might otherwise be the case in some of the other tax credits we've been dealing with. Because, of course, we can use that which is produced regarding Oregon in Oregon to better promote our state. So you have the added value, if you will, of that element of what you're about. So that's one of the reasons I am supporting as a device, as something that's getting a lot of very hard looks this time. And the nature of the device, it doesn't lend itself to easy conversation. It's a complex device, and you guys is in particular is complex because of its kind of a different approach and how it's awarded, if you will. Are there further comments while we have these folks here? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
So just to remind everyone, Representative Sheehan has moved that the Dash 2 amendments be adopted. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted. Is there a motion?
I move, Mr. Chair, the 2167 to the Committee on Tax Breaks with no recommendation.
Representative Smith has moved House Bill 2167 to the Joint Tax Cuts Committee with no recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Sheehan.
Mr. Chair, I would prefer to move it to the Tax Credits Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
President Meyer.
I also would prefer that due pass recommendation.
I would prefer it with no recommendation.
Is there further discussion on this motion? Representative Nathanson.
Mr. Chair, could we just take a moment at ease to think about this?
Yes, please. We're at ease.
Procedurally, how do we do this if we disagree on...
back in order, so the committee will come back to order. Representative Smith, can you restate your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Am I allowed to ask question or discuss before I restate my motion? And the reason I ask, Mr. Chair, is if I literally am the only person who thinks this is a good idea, I'm happy to withdraw my motion. If I'm the only person who doesn't just want to send it down with a due pass.
I think that's a safe assumption.
All right. You want to have the vote anyway? It'd be kind of fun. I'll restate my amendment because that's what I restate my motion because that's what I was told to do. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2167 to the Joint Committee on, as amended, to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits with no recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Do you wish to withdraw your now correctly stated motion?
Yeah. Okay.
Motion's withdrawn. Do I hear another motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2167 as amended to the Joint Tax Credits Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sheehan moves House Bill 2167 to the Joint Tax Credits Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? And let me just point out there's been some confusion about where this bill goes next, and it does go to the Joint Tax Credits Committee, not to Ways and Means. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to recall something that's probably obvious to most of us, that a very important reason for the existence of that tax credits committee is to sort out priorities. Which credits have more bang for the buck, which have more value, how much money, if there's any money that's going to be allocated to this kind of a tax expenditure, which proportion of that piggy bank of cash, if you will, should go to this kind of credit versus that kind of credit. And that's what they do. They'll get all these ideas of things that have some potential value and sort out which is the most important or the most useful. And that's what we're doing. We're sending it to the people who will get the full list and consider it with all the rest.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my comment would be is that I would hope that if we're selecting tax credits to send down to the tax credit committee, they would be tax credits we want to send there, that we would want them to support, as opposed to sending them things that we don't really recommend them supporting. So that's why I choose to do this with a due pass recommendation.
Is there further discussion, Representative Smith?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'll be a yes on the motion, and let me explain. There are two reasons I like this, and also that differentiates it with some others. One, I think we have been shown a greater causal link to economic development impact with this one than with some others, right? It doesn't seem to be a case where the amount of film activity is going to be the same in Oregon with it or without it, and so really we just do it because it seems like a nice thing to do to a set of people we like. So that's the first reason. Second reason is I really appreciate the work of the proponents to amend the bill and to work on the bill and to muddle with it, and I think that one of our duties as we enter this new world of trying to prioritize, trying to evaluate, that it's our duty, in fact, to muddle with it. And so just the fact, I mean, even setting aside the content of the muddling, the very fact we muddled makes me a little more supportive. So I do appreciate that, and I'll be voting yes on the motion.
Thank you, Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the risk of saying something positive about a bill on this committee, this is my favorite thing we've done on this committee so far. I really like this bill. I'm not a fan of tax credits. I love this one, and the fact that the governor's office was so great in putting together amendments that accurately reflected our feedback so quickly, I'm just really thankful. I wish everything worked this way. I'm very happy to vote for this bill.
I'm tempted, Representative Sheehan, to note that this bill doesn't need a carrier, so I'm wondering if that's why you're so positive about it. Any other comments?
I just want to note for the record that we do have approval from both speakers to send the bill to tax credits instead of the Ways and Means.
Thank you, Zach. Anything further?
Yes, Representative Weiner. Get my quick 2 cents on. I appreciate supporting this bill, especially since we had the cast of Wild Hogs here the other day, and that's why I'm throwing my support behind this.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Lindsay?
Excused.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Chair Reed?
Excused.
Chair Benz?
Aye. Having received the majority of those House, actually, the majority of those House Bill 2167 as amended is moved to the Joint Tax Credits Committee with the due pass recommendation noting Representative Lindsay and Chair Reed are excused. And with that, we will open a work session on House Bill 3596. Zach.
House Bill 3596 empowers the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay to own and operate a rail line connecting the station of Danabo in Lane County to the station of Cookeville in Coos County.
Zach, I understand we are ready to work this bill.
And yes.
Do I hear a motion?
I move, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3596 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Sheehan moves House Bill 3596 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the House Bill 20081 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, noting President Lindsay and Chair Reed are excused. With that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill. We need a carrier. The carrier would be Representative Roblin.
You may want to change the number.
God bless America. Which
bill are we doing right now?
That was, we just voted on 3596. Okay. Is that
you said 2081?
Yeah, you threw me a little bit.
I'm sorry. 3596 is the bill we just voted on, and now we're going to move to House Bill 2468. Zach.
House Bill 2468 removes the sunset on provisions that establish requirements, unless parties agree otherwise, for motor vehicle liability arbitration proceedings regarding uninsured motorist coverage.
And colleagues, you may recall we heard testimony on this. It was the four-year sunset, which is now being removed. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2468 to the floor with the due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to Judiciary.
Actually, the subsequent referral has been removed as well from the speakers, so it would just be moving to the floor.
Can you restate your motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2468 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Widener has moved House Bill 2468 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yeah.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't recall, and this may have been a bill that was discussed on a day when I was away. I don't recall if there was opposition to this bill, if anybody remembers any.
It was.
Representative Widener.
This one, both the insurance companies and basically trial lawyers came in and they were both supportive of it. It's something they were trying over a four-year period.
That means I'm supposed to like it more or I'm supposed to like it less?
Everybody's neutral on it. They think it's a good thing that we have in place right now, and it's worked out with the third-party arbitrator.
Thank you for your indulgence.
I might also add, it was, I believe, State Farm and the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association that appeared supporting this bill. Is there further discussion? Would the clerk call the roll?
Representative Lindsay?
Yes, excused.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Chair Reed?
Excused.
Chair
Benz? Aye. And House Bill 2468 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The carrier will be, someone voluntary carrying. Yes, Representative Widener will carry. And with that, we have one public hearing left, and we have a representative that wants to speak, but how long is it going to take her to get here?
She's here.
She's here? There she is. With that, I will open the public hearing on House Bill 3024.
Whatever.
Apologize, Representative. I didn't see you.
Well,
I'm invisible.
I hope you haven't been here the full 2 hours.
I have been. And you're all invited to follow us back to the beautiful Oregon coast. Okay.
I will only note that we will soon be joined by the chair of the healthcare committee. So please talk quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and Co-Vice Chairs. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, the beautiful upper left coast, including Tillamook. And today I'm here to introduce House Bill 3024 at the request of one of my judges in Tillamook County who is here beside me, and he brought his personal protection with him, too. And he wrote to me last year and asked that we do what we do best here, and that is make a good law better. So I'll turn it over to him to explain the details.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Vice Chair, I'm here with Deputy Ben Berger from the Tillamook County Sheriff's Department. My name is Neil Lemery. I'm the Justice of the Peace from Tillamook County. And Deputy Berger had a case a couple years ago involving the ATV law, and Deputy Berger is the primary law enforcement officer in Sand Lake, which is our major ATV recreation area. And the issue was the definition of dangerous operation of ATV. And we discovered during the trial that the language of the statute requires a violator to commit three separate areas of bad activity, bad kind of conduct out on the sand, in order to be convicted of dangerous operation of ATV. Either any one of those paragraphs in and of itself is a bad situation. It poses a danger to the public, danger to the riders, and everyone involved. And so our proposal today is to change or and to or. When we talked to Legislative Council about it, they also noticed a statute next to that that also describes duties of parents of minors who are operating ATV. And the same problem is there, too. And so the bill also changes and to or. This is a safety measure. Deputy Berger deals with a huge number of people at Sand Lake. Their office gives me about 800 to 1,000 tickets a year from Sand Lake. Many of those are safety issues. Many of those are very bad driving situations. And a lot of the conduct that I see involves dangerous operation of ATV or issues with parents. And so this bill changes that. So I sort of see this as a housekeeping thing, and I think it clarifies the intent of the legislature that any one of these activities is something that is of concern and should be unlawful. So I urge your support. If you have any questions, we're able to answer that, hopefully.
Thank you. Did you want to testify, officer, on this bill?
I certainly can.
Please.
I'm Ben Berger. I'm a deputy with Tillamook County Sheriff's Office. I'm in support of this. As you said, my primary patrol area is Sand Lake Recreation Area. Consists mostly of ATV activities. Again, basically, this changes and to or, and what this allows us to do is, for the last 2 years, we've been calling this the lottery ticket because three things had to be in place for you to take enforcement action in what was pretty much a worst-case scenario, which was kids riding by themselves. So to take action, they would have to be by themselves. Parks and Recreation's ATV committee is now requiring kids have the ATV safety card, so that was a requirement under this law, as well as meeting rider fit of the ATV they were on. So they had to be in violation of all three things, so not accompanied by a parent, not have an ATV safety card, and not fit the vehicle they were on for it to be a violation. Any one of those three things is a massive safety problem. And my particular area is 1,000 acres, and on a busy weekend, I will have 2,000 to 4,000 people in the area. If you have any questions about it, I'm happy to answer it.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? None. You've either completely convinced us or the other.
And versus yours.
Yeah, I know.
Well, thank you very much. We can't work the bill today, even if we wanted to, and we might, because it's just a public hearing. We really appreciate you making the trip here and sharing with us the concern. So I'm sure there will be further discussion regarding your bill. So no questions? Oh, there is a question. Representative Nathanson.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question, but because they did travel to be here, I want them to know I was listening, and not asking a question doesn't mean I'm not interested or that I don't get it. I'm paying attention.
Thank you for that. Anything further? Thank you very much, Representative, and thank you very much, Judge and Officer. And with that, I'll close the public hearing, and nothing further to come before the committee. We are adjourned.